From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Americans are living longer, but are, as a whole, sicker. America spends far more on health care per person than any other high-income country, yet lags behind on a range of health indicators. Preventable chronic diseases and behavioral issues, including opioid addiction, are on the rise across all populations, but the most disadvantaged communities are disproportionately affected. Improving economic prosperity is among the priorities announced by the nation's doctor when he was confirmed. Yesterday, U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams outlined a community-based initiative to a group at the Federal Reserve Bank in Atlanta. It's not something we might expect from a Surgeon General. I spoke with Dr. Adams before that event. I asked him, what is the connection between the economy and physical health?
Well, we know that when businesses invest in health, they see returns in terms of absenteeism, in terms of productivity, in terms of being able to attract talented workforces across the board. And what I'm trying to do is translate our health programs and health metrics into a language that resonates with both voters and policymakers. We know that the number one issue people vote on across the country pretty consistently is jobs and the economy. And so I want folks to understand that if you want higher wages, if you want more jobs in your community, if you want healthy consumers buying your products, then you need to care about the fact that America is spending more on health care than any other country and is not getting the results that we should be getting, is not getting the return on investment.
So who are you working with to make this happen?
We're working with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. We're working with the Federal Reserve. We're working with major businesses like Dow Chemical. We're proud of the work that Target and IBM are doing. There are lots of folks out there who are starting to see that so much of health is not just healthcare. As a matter of fact, studies show that about 90% of health is not healthcare, but is the environment that we live in, is the behaviors that we engage in throughout the day, and that there are things that businesses and communities can do to nudge those behaviors in a positive direction by putting better choices in front of individuals.
Well, you've made these kind of partnerships sort of a hallmark, I think, of your tenure, getting people together, working in the business community, healthcare professionals, nonprofits, decision makers. Give us an idea of a concrete model. Where are you seeing that working, those kind of partnerships?
In Richmond, Indiana, the second lady, Mrs. Pence, and I visited Belden, and it's an example around the opioid epidemic, which is really forcing people to take a hard look at community health. They had to interview over 200 people to fill just a couple of jobs because so many people failed the drug test. Mm-hmm. And what they decided to do was to start testing people up front. And if people either said they needed help or tested positive, instead of not hiring them and not telling them, they offer them treatment. And those folks, if they successfully complete treatment, then have a job available on the back end. That's an example of a business taking an innovative approach to community health and wellness.
Let's talk about the opioid crisis, because you came out of the gate with a three-pronged approach to treating opioid crisis, normalizing naloxone, that can be called Narcan or Evzia, which helps revive many people who have overdosed. And a second change, is more difficult. It's a behavioral shift. It's changing how we talk about and think about addiction. What kind of changes do you want to see?
One of the things that I want to do is help folks understand that addiction is a chronic disease. Yes, there are bad choices that are often made that lead to addiction, but you can't make a good choice if literally your brain is not functioning properly. And we know from looking at the scans that your brain changes when you're under the influence of drugs, of alcohol, of other substances. We also know that unfortunately, a lot of us played a part and folks going down the pathway to addiction. My own brother, as many people know, is in prison right now. He committed crimes to support his addiction, and his addiction started with a pill that he was given at a party. 4 out of 5 heroin users got started with a prescription opioid, usually from someone else's medicine cabinet. So one of the things that's important for your listeners to know, particularly around the holidays, is that they have a very real potential to be someone else's first drug dealer because of unsecured and undisposed of opioids that are often left lying around.
So addiction is a chronic disease that must be treated in the same way hypertension or diabetes might be treated. But how do you change minds about that? There is still, I think, a lot of moralism and a lot of judgment around addiction.
I think one of the ways you change minds is by sharing stories. I don't like sharing with the world the story about my brother, but the more I do it, the more people come forward to me and say, you know, that's also happening to my family. I can relate. And once we start to see it not as us and them, the good guys and the bad guys, but of everyone being affected, I think that helps to change people's minds. I think we also have to show stories of recovery. Unfortunately, and I was talking with Robert just a few days ago, who is now a recovery counselor but used to be addicted to heroin, and Robert will tell you that we're just inundating people with bad news, with terrible statistics, with deaths and overdoses, and folks start to get hardened to that. But the more we share those stories of recovery, stories such as Robert's story, such as Jonathan's story, who is now a peer recovery coach after being revived with naloxone, the more folks will start to recognize this as a disease that can be treated and not a moral failing that we can arrest our way out of.
The third focus that you announced was on prevention. So where does treatment actually come into this?
Well, treatment is a very important part of it. I lift up naloxone, but that's just the first step. We don't want to just revive someone over and over again and not provide them a bridge to treatment. And so the federal government has increased the number of medication-assisted treatment providers. We're working with groups such as Project Echo to try to increase telemedicine access to treatment services. And we need to rethink the way that we deliver treatment. There simply is never going to be enough addiction providers to meet the need in the traditional inpatient, everyone see a psychiatrist sense. We need to bring all of our providers to the forefront and have them armed to be able to provide treatment both outpatient and inpatient. And we're starting to see success. You know, it took over 20 years for us to get to where we are, and we're not going to dig our way out of this hole in just 2 years. But we are slowly starting to see progress. We're starting to see minds change. We're starting to see stigma become less and less. And I'm confident that we will put out this fire. But what I want to make sure we do is use this opportunity to also prevent the next fire from occurring by educating the public.
Well, one of the things that your office has done and that you've announced is really important to you as a doctor, as a scientist, is to use evidence-based information when communicating health outcomes and dangers. And you're working in an administration that's been accused by the Union of Concerned Scientists, among others, with sidelining evidence-based data. And we've seen orders from the EPA, the Department of the Interior, agencies restricting the use of data. Have you found your priorities to be at all in conflict with the administration?
The most honest answer I can give you is I have never in my year and a half in office felt that I couldn't go out there and speak to the science, that I was being muzzled in any way, shape, or form. As a matter of fact, folks have continually prodded me to make sure I'm out there preaching the science, particularly about opioids and addiction.
In addition to preaching about evidence-based science, one of the things that, again, I want to return to this idea of partnerships, you were speaking in front of a group of police leaders in Boston recently, and you talked about local control, local innovation. That's what I'm all about. In Massachusetts, for example, they have programs that allow addicts to turn in drugs at the police station without fear of arrest. So when you're looking at making big changes like this across the country, what do you think? I mean, would something like that work in Georgia?
Well, one of the things that we want to do is both allow local control, but also evaluate these programs. We want to make sure when these experiments are happening naturally across the country that we're carefully looking at whether or not we are truly getting the outcomes that we desire and whether the benefits outweigh the risk. And that's why the CDC, which is right here in Atlanta, is so important. That's why it's important that we work with academic partners to be able to say, yes, if you do X, you will get Y. But it's also important to understand that just because something works in Boston, Massachusetts, doesn't mean it's going to work in Atlanta, Georgia, or Dallas, Texas.
Well, also in Boston, you talked about federal drug classifications needing to be revised, and a number of news organizations really seized upon that. You know, the Surgeon General says we should reclassify marijuana, now Schedule 1 drug, like heroin and LSD. Is that true? Could we want to clarify that statement?
Absolutely. That was mischaracterized. It was a conversation that was asking about the classification schedule, and my statement was that we need to make sure we are making it as easy as possible for folks to do research on marijuana in particular, not that we need to reclassify marijuana. Certainly, I don't support that, but I do think that we need to evaluate everything that we do. And if folks are out there implementing marijuana policy across the country with little to no evidence in many cases, I think one of the things we need to try to do as a federal government is to make sure we are facilitating research so that these policy solutions can be influenced and led by, where possible, the scientific information.
Well, the science is one thing, the behavior is another. As you said, in 2017, the CDC reported 80,000 Americans died from influenza. This was the highest number in decades. 180 of them children, 80% of those not vaccinated. So what are your hopes for establishing effective community health initiatives, partnerships with businesses, if even basics like vaccination are not penetrating the population or changing behavior?
Flu is a great example. The flu is estimated to cost every county across America $1 to $2 million every year in lost productivity and in healthcare costs. And so we need to help folks understand that yes, it is a personal decision as to whether or not you get a flu shot, but it's a personal decision that has implications that are much greater than whether or not you get the flu. Your grandmother, your newborn niece or nephew, someone else's newborn niece or nephew in the community may die because you passed along the flu, even if you never felt a symptom in the first place. The community may not be able to experience wage growth or job growth because they're spending so much money treating the negative outcomes of the flu that you spread. The more that we can show that we are all in this together and that it's not just simply about a single decision in an individual's health, but it's about the overall physical, mental, and financial health of communities and of our entire country, the more I think we'll be able to get people on board. At least that's what I hope for, and that's the way I'm looking at some of these difficult problems across the country. And it's the way that I've seen have success, particularly in my time in Indiana, bringing folks together, showing them that a common cause can lead to better partnerships.
Well, Dr. Adams, it's great to have you back in Atlanta. And I know on a previous flight to Atlanta, you had a pretty eventful time. Anything happened this time?
Fortunately, nothing happened this time. For your listeners' information, I was on a Delta flight and had to respond to an individual who was having trouble, health problems on that flight, and I was very, very glad to be able to step up and provide those services, and the individual actually ended up doing okay.
I can only imagine when the Delta flight attendant called, is there a doctor in the house? She may not have expected the Surgeon General to be there.
No, they were a little shocked.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Virginia. Have a wonderful day. And get your flu shot if you haven't, and encourage everyone around you to do the same.
U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams, he was in Atlanta speaking to a group at the Federal Reserve Bank yesterday, and he encouraged us to check in with him about the development of the partnerships that he was talking about. We'll definitely do that. Stay with us for a conversation about black farmers, increasing the rare in the United States. What kind of barriers do they face? We'll speak with an author of a book about the subject after the break, when On Second Thought continues. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1920, African-American farmers owned 14% of all American farmland. Today, it's just 2%. The vast majority of them live in the South. That's according to U.S. Census data from the Department of Agriculture. A new book encourages a new generation of black farmers and places ownership of land and production of healthy food squarely on the path of self-determination for people of color. Leah Penniman is co-founder of Soulfire Farm and author of Farming While Black, Soulfire Farm's Practical Guide to Liberation on the Land. And she's joining us now from a studio in Petersburg, New York. Leah, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. And you actually grew up in rural Massachusetts, surrounded by forest, and increasingly, I think, in that part of the world, second homes. Tell us a little bit about your childhood there.
Well, I grew up in a very poor, working-class white town in the forest of central Massachusetts, and our family was the only mixed-race family in town for almost all of my childhood. So needless to say, in such a conservative area, peers were cruel and friends were hard to come by. And so my siblings and I found solace in connecting with the natural world, and it became the foundation of a lifelong commitment to environmental stewardship and relationship with the land.
Did you ever think of yourself becoming a farmer?
Oh, no. No, my grandparents fled the red clays of the South and tried to get as far away as they could from that life of stooping and sharecropping. And so I envisioned myself as, you know, an environmental scientist or wildlife biologist. I had never considered farming as a young person.
When you first became involved with farming and food justice, this is through a project, the Food Project in Boston, Massachusetts. What does food justice mean for you?
Well, food justice is not just access to food, not just having enough calories and vitamins and minerals. It's really about agency and self-determination in the food system. It has to do with ownership of land, fair wages and good working conditions for farm workers, and the ability to have diets that are culturally relevant and that bring nourishment and life for our people.
Well, you do quote somebody, I can't remember who it is in the book, that says you can be killed by a gun or killed by bad food. Do you think people in especially contemporary America associate food with activism?
You know, a lot of people look at me with surprise when I talk about racial injustice in the food system because they never think about food as a political issue. But of course, it very much is. I mean, everything from the skewed racial divisions in land ownership in this country, where well over 95% of the rural land is controlled by white folks, to the fact that if you're a person of color, you know, you're only 25% as likely to have a supermarket in your neighborhood as a white person. And so all along the entire food system, there's racial schism and there's disadvantage for folks of color. So it's a very political sphere.
So it is political and it is contemporary. But as you are working on other rural farms in the Northeast after the Food Project, this was for you kind of an awakening to understanding sustainable agriculture differently. How did your own process evolve?
Well, I'll tell you, from the very first time that the smell of cilantro lingered in the creases of my fingers after that first day at the Food Project, I was totally hooked on farming. It was a space where I could do what the two things I love most. I could care for the environment and I could stand up for justice in the community, because we took all of that produce and we, you know, served it at low-income farmers markets and in soup kitchens and so on. And so I continued to farm, but it was disillusioning, honestly, in my later teens and early 20s, because unlike the Food Project, most farms were very white spaces. And I started to feel like a traitor to my people, that I had to choose between the earth and racial justice. I didn't see another intersection until we created it.
And you did create that in Soul Fire Farm in upstate New York. And the photographs, this is a book. It's like a practical guide. You get, you know, advice on finding land and financing and purchasing and planting fruit trees and all sorts of things, establishing land trust, determining slopes for irrigation. What for you, Leah, was the biggest revelation or learning curve?
Oh, my goodness. So many. I mean, this land first claimed us back in 2006, and we had very little pocket money. We'd been saving by having our family of four live in a, you know, one room all together, these dilapidated buildings. And this land was what we could afford. And the reason that we really started it in the first place is because it was very difficult for us to get food to eat for our own children living in the south end of Albany, which is what the USDA terms a food desert. And our neighbors started clamoring and saying, we need you to start a farm that will bring food to us, to our block, to our doorsteps. So that was our vision. And we were pretty naive about the amount of work it would take and the cost. And even with a decade of farming experience, you know, it was a lot. So I would say the biggest learning curve was the amount of grit that it takes to really actualize a vision of food justice, not just theorize about it.
Well, and there's a lot of practical tips and resources in the books and a lot of photographs of you all farming. And you just look impossibly sparklingly healthy and happy. But there is like a strong collective. We get a lot of history here of, for example, Black tenant farmers unions, cooperatives among Black farmers and land trusts, like the New Communities Farm Collective in Southwest Georgia. This was started in 1969. Tell us about the founding of that and what were the founders aiming for?
Absolutely. Well, I've had the blessing and privilege to get to know Mama Shirley Sherrod in the past few years, and have been at some convenings of Black farmers in the state of Georgia discussing our future on land. But this project started well before I was born in 1969, and Shirley Sherrod and Charles Sherrod and many others, in fact, 500 Black families, got together and said, we need a way to have more self-sufficiency, because as sharecroppers and tenant farmers, we're noticing that as soon as we get involved in civil rights, we are kicked off of our land and out of our homes by the white landowners. And so we need a space of our own. And they traveled to Israel and other places around the world to see models of collective land ownership and settled on creating the very first community land trust. They had almost 6,000 acres in Albany, Georgia. As I mentioned, 500 families. They were running a farm, building houses. And that was a big threat to the status quo in the white supremacist South. And so they experienced a lot of violence. In fact, bombing and diluting of their fertilizers, and eventually lost their land. And they became some of the lead plaintiffs in suing the federal government for discrimination in the Pigford v. Glickman case, which became the largest civil rights settlement in the history of this country.
Yeah, give us a little bit of background on this case.
Absolutely. So, you know, for folks who don't know, farming is a highly subsidized and highly regulated industry. And so the U.S. Department of Agriculture and its big piece of legislation, the Farm Bill, provide billions of dollars of support for farmers. You know, everything from crop insurance to loans, crop allotments, technical assistance. And these are entitlement programs. Farmers are supposed to be able to get them. But because they're controlled at the county level and people's individual and collective bias can creep in, what's happened over the decades is Black farmers have been excluded from these programs. So, you know, there'll be a drought and a white farmer will go into the county office and get a nice loan for irrigation, and a Black farmer will have their application denied. And the cumulative effect of this was the loss of 14 million acres of land through foreclosure and displacement. So farmers got together finally and said, this is enough. You know, in 1962, the U.S. Commission of Civil Rights found that the federal government was the number one cause of the decline of the Black farmer. It took decades to pull together the evidence, but eventually the USDA, you know, admitted that they were at fault and paid $2 billion to the claimants in 1999.
Yeah, so this
is... It was too little too late because these farmers were in their 90s and they each got $50,000 and so on. But it was important symbolic victory to say, you know, we didn't leave the land voluntarily. It really was a refugee crisis, essentially a foreclosure crisis.
Right. So this was, you know, not just your opinion or the opinion of activists, but this was found, the data was all pulled together and the court of law settled for the plaintiffs. But how about opportunities after Pigford? Now, you were in Atlanta earlier this year at a meeting of Black farmers discussing the next steps against or to continue to work despite the USDA discrimination. Has anything changed inside of those policies?
That's a great question. You know, to the USDA's credit, some things certainly have changed. The 2501 program, which is for disadvantaged farmers, including minority farmers, you know, has some increased funding. They are paying attention and collecting more statistics around the race and ethnicity of folks who are receiving funding. But, you know, together with Yes Magazine just a couple of years ago, we did a little number crunching to see if the actual result was different in terms of who was getting the funds. And there still is a lot of disparity in all of the programs except for the EQIP, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program. There is racial disparity in all other programs. So there's a long way to go, even though the intention is now there. Yeah, and we did meet in the South, you know, something that I love to think about is my generation as the returning generation of Black farmers. Mm. You know, our grandparents fled the South, and we're now realizing that our grandparents left a little piece of our heritage, our culture, even our souls behind, and we're looking to reclaim that. So the big work right now is to get these Northerners, many of whom are urban and who are getting a start in urban farming, to connect with the legacy farmers in the South and try to figure out things like land transfer and skills transfer.
The average age of Black farmers in the U.S. is now 62, and we're talking with Leah Penniman, who's urging a new generation of people of color to farm, not just for food production, but for liberation, as she says, continuing an historical legacy of farming while Black, and that is the name of her new book. But let's get to that, Leah. I mean, besides policies dissuading black farmers. How about that perception, maybe particularly in the South, that farming is too country, too mired in associations of poverty and limited choices, and as you said, you know, stooping over the fields?
Oh, that is so true. You know, as my good friend, urban farmer Chris Bolden Newsom says, the land was the scene of the crime. But I would add to that, the land was not the criminal. You know, so while we did experience hundreds of years of slavery and sharecropping and tenant farming and violence when we tried to own our own land, driving us off, that's not the whole history. You know, if we reach back beyond and around that, we have thousands of years of noble legacy of being connected to and innovating on land. You know, everything from vermicomposting, which is composting with worms, to raised beds, to rotating crops, these have roots in African agricultural wisdom. And that's the part of the story that's not often told. And a big part of why I wrote Farming While Black was to uplift these noble and dignified narratives of the way we've been connected to land as black people.
Well, and some of the examples you give in addition to Soulfire Farm are the Combahee River. Am I saying that right? Combahee River Community.
I think you got it.
Tell us about the women in this community and what they stood for.
Oh, I mean, there were just so many examples of collective land ownership and farming going back. So this was during the Civil War. You know, a lot of men were away fighting, and the women said, you know, we're not going to work for white folks. We're actually going to go get our own lands and create our own enterprises and work together. And they became a model and an inspiration for many generations to come. You know, they were an inspiration to Fannie Lou Hamer, who started the Freedom Farm Cooperative. They were an inspiration to the Rapp Road community in Albany, which were some Mississippi sharecroppers who came up to our area and formed their own community. And so there's a lot of examples of autonomy and collectivism throughout our history.
And individuals like Mama Isola, who's now 80, she led a workshop on pickling that you write about in the book. Is it hard to find people with institutional knowledge like her now?
Wow. Well, actually, it's a timely question because Mama Isola, who is a dear one to us, actually just passed away last week.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, and so we laid her to rest just a few days ago in Schenectady, and so she's on my mind. Wonderful, wonderful elder. You know, she grew up in a time where they grew everything. You know, the only thing they went to the store to buy was sugar and flour, and everything else from the hogs to the vegetables was grown on the farm. So she came to our farm and taught us how to can and pickle and preserve our food, and it was just so wonderful because while you can learn those things on the internet, there is so much cultural knowledge that's passed on when you get face to face with an elder. And elders are not hard to find. In fact, I think that a big mistake that the younger generation of activists makes is ignoring and excluding and invisibilizing our elders. And we need to make sure that we are sitting at their feet and not making the same mistakes they did because we actually take the time to listen to them.
But you also use YouTube videos for your education, right?
Yes, of course.
Getting it from everywhere. But this is interesting. You know, when in that segment, and of course, I was reading about fermentation again, because fermentation is a thing. But you bring up this association of healthy cooking and food preservation as a white people thing. How do you, you know, undo that kind of association? How do you build a different narrative?
I mean, it's a great question because it really is a myth that healthy cooking and preservation is a white people thing. You know, Fannie Lou Hamer said, if you have 400 quarts of greens and gumbo soup canned for the winter, nobody can push you around or tell you what to do. So we have a legacy of making healthy foods. You know, a big shout out to the Old Ways organization because they've created food pyramids based on African heritage cooking and other cuisines around the world to remind us that, you know, it's not the USDA that's defining what healthy is, that our ancestors really have known. And the way that we shift that is by actually creating those culturally relevant foods in a healthy manner. Like, we don't need it to be kale salad and sunflower butter around our table. You know, we can make our derriac pois, we can make our pois congo, like our Haitian foods, using these local healthy vegetables. And that's familiar to our palates and to the palates of our children, and they will embrace that.
Well, there's so many aspects to this. In fact, there's a chapter in the book on healing from trauma. Would you talk to us about how farming can be both healing and in some ways re-traumatizing and how you have been able to find healing?
Well, yeah, something that's been really amazing is we've been running these week-long beginner farmer training programs now for several years. We've had 500 people come through. And I started out being very focused, exclusively focused on teaching folks things like cation exchange capacity and how to interpret your soil test. But then in the feedback forums, people would say, you know, after a week on the land, I'm going to put down my cigarettes or my marijuana and not do that anymore. I'm going to leave this toxic, abusive marriage. I'm going to leave this dead-end job. I'm not settling anymore. So on and so forth. And I'm like, what is going on here? And this diverges from the science a bit, but I really believe what our ancestors have believed, that the earth herself is alive, not just a material being, and that she has lessons for us about who we're meant to be and that we belong and how to heal. So when we actually make that introduction back to the land, and we have our bare feet on the earth and we breathe that fresh air, there's a remembering of things we didn't know we forgot and a healing that just emerges. And I wouldn't say this if it hasn't happened 1,000 times, but it has every single time. So I really do think that when we're able to come to land on our own terms, like we chose, no one made us come, and we're growing food for our own communities, the land is able to do that healing. And it's actually not re-traumatizing. It's profoundly spiritual, it's profoundly emotional, and it's really where we need to be headed as a people.
Well, Leah Penniman, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Leah Penniman, she is a Soulfire Farm co-founder. She's an activist and she is a writer, and we spoke with her via Skype. Her new book is called Farming While Black, Soulfire Farm's Practical Guide to Liberation on the Land. And stay with us. Atlanta native and chef Ronald Sue makes a name for himself on Netflix. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Atlanta native chef Ronald Sue stars in a new competitive cooking show called The Final Table on Netflix.
We're on the plate now.
Right here.
We just have to push.
90 seconds remaining.
I don't want to go home, man.
And Ronald joins me in the studio today to discuss his culinary inspirations in the world of reality TV cooking. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Virginia.
Boy, that sounds like some high pressure stuff.
It was pretty high pressure, but coming from La Bernardin and working in that kind of environment, that was even more high pressure for me. So, you know, the only added pressure that I felt on that TV show was just the cameras in your faces. And now I have a microphone in my face. So, you know, it was a good prep.
Well, so this is you now. You're a media star now.
I guess I'm Insta famous, I guess, for a little bit. Yeah.
Tell me about La Bernardin. You were the executive sous chef and creative director. And this is a New York restaurant with Chef Eric Ripert. He's written a couple books. He's a terrific writer as well as chef. He's been a mainstay on shows like Top Chef and was friends with the late Anthony Bourdain. Do you remember your first days there at La Bernardin?
I do. My first stage, I started off like everyone else did, you know, making the salad. We called it the market salad, where we would get the freshest and seasonal vegetables from the market, and then we would compose our salad that day. And you're not allowed to season any fish. You know, La Bernardin being a seafood restaurant, you're not allowed to season any fish until you've mastered the salad, which usually took about 2 weeks. So that was the thing that struck me the most, was like, wow, they care so much about the basics of the fundamentals of cooking, like how much salt and pepper or lemon juice you're putting on your fish, that they don't even let you do it for the first 2 weeks. And you had to work your way up and master that on salads before you get to touch any protein.
I'm curious how you got to that vaunted position. You come from a family of restaurateurs, right?
That's right, I do. Yes.
Your parents had Chinese restaurants?
Yep, my family actually had the first Chinese restaurant in Henry County, which I believe opened up in like 85, if I'm not mistaken, 84, 85.
What was it called?
It was called Hunan Village. Mm-hmm. And if you find any old advertisements, we were the best Chinese restaurant in the world. So
that's a very big claim.
Yep.
There, yeah. In Henry County. And your siblings are behind the Sweet Auburn Barbecue Shop.
That's correct. They opened that up, I think. Well, it depends how you want to look at it. They started off with a few burrito shops on the south side of in Henry County as well. And he and a friend of his decided to partner up and start a barbecue kind of like food truck right out in the parking lot where their burrito shop is, Gezzo's Grill in Henry County. And, you know, that kind of blossomed into a storefront in the Sweet Auburn Market over on Edgewood,
mm-hmm.
and that blossomed into a full brick and mortar over in the Highlands, over on North Island.
So for you, did it feel like an inevitability that you'd be involved in restaurants?
Kind of, yes. And ironically enough, out of the three, me, my brother, and sister, I was the only one that actually went to school for any formal kind of restaurant training. My brother and sister both, you know, my sister went to school and she was pre-med at the University of Georgia. My brother studied international business, and I went to UGA as well. And I was in the business school, and I realized I hate numbers and stuff like that. And I've always cooked part-time, and I was like, you know what, I'm not going to do this the rest of my life. I want to find something I love to do. And I grew up in the restaurant industry, and I always gravitated towards the kitchen side, and I've always had part-time jobs working in kitchens. And I was like, you know what, this is something I think I'm going to do. And I was going through that quarter-life crisis that every college kid goes through, and my roommate at the time was very pivotal in that, and kind of, you know, we were just drinking a beer one day at night and just talked about our futures. And he was like, Ronald, you should consider being a chef. And my mother always pushed me to do a white-collar job, like being a doctor or a lawyer or something. And I was very hesitant to tell my mother I wanted to pivot and become a chef. But I did, and she was actually extremely supportive. And I told her, you know, in order to lessen the blow of this news, I was like, look, I'll finish my degree in business. But after that, I'm going to, you know, go to culinary school. And my mom, very surprisingly, was like, Ronald, don't waste your time. Drop out next semester and go do the go find the course you want and do it. Don't waste your time like that.
Wow. Where'd you go to school to learn the chef skills?
So I went to Le Cordon Bleu in Sydney, Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the reason why was my roommate at the time was also heading there. But after researching more, I realized that Australia was such a hotbed of Asian fusion cuisine, and me being Chinese and my parents coming from Malaysia and having this hodgepodge of Asian cultures behind me, I was like, you know what, Australia could be very good. And so I went there to learn French cuisine. But even my curriculum had a lot of Asian influence in it, too.
Well, what kind of dishes helped you develop that passion for food? You know, what were the childhood staples that stick with you before you found French cooking?
Well, one thing in particular was cooking in my parents' restaurant was when I learned how to make fried rice. So, you know, I was barely tall enough to reach the handle of the wok, you know, at my parents' wok station. And my uncle at the time was, you know, I was hungry, and I was like asking him to make me some fried rice. And he was walking me through the steps of making it. And I was like, what goes in fried rice? And he was telling me the recipe that we made at the world's best Chinese restaurant. Yunnan Village, just kidding. And anyways, so he was walking me through the recipe, and he was like, oh, you put, you know, a little bit of garlic in there. You could put some soy sauce, some cooking wine, some vegetables. But, you know, what really struck me the most was he was like, but Ronald, you can put whatever you want in there. If you want to put Snickers bars in there, you can. It's cooking. You can make it whatever you want. And I think that's what appealed to me the most. And that was probably my first real lesson.
That's what you make for yourself. I mean, it's always funny to hear what chefs make for themselves at the end of the night. Is fried rice your go-to meal?
It is. It's pretty inexpensive. We always have rice in our pantry, and there's always ingredients you can throw in from your refrigerator, whether it's eggs, bacon. If you do have any kind of vegetables, it always goes well when you fry it up with some rice.
So after school, presumably you went to New York.
Yes. Well, not directly after. So after I finished school, I actually didn't finish culinary school because it got too expensive. So not only did I drop out of college, I dropped out of culinary school.
You got a good record.
Yep. So after I left Australia, I moved back to Atlanta to work. And, you know, I took a week off just to kind of reacclimate myself to the time change. And then after a week of finding a place to live and everything, I then would drive around Atlanta and look for a place to go work at. And I ended up applying at a restaurant called Dish in the Virginia Highlands, where my first real mentor, Sherry Davis, was a chef there. And I worked there for a year and a half, and I progressed very fast there. I think after 3 months, she ended up making me the chef de cuisine, and I did that for like total time, a year and a half. And Sherry worked at Le Bernardin before moving down to Atlanta, and when I told her I wanted to progress my career, she she recommended to go up to New York and work at Le Bernardin. And she's really the reason why I got my foot in the door at Le Bernardin.
And then you came back to Atlanta after that.
That's right. That's right. I was there in New York total time for 10 years, which really feels more like 50 years. But then after doing New York for 10 years, I moved back and to kind of work on my next project, which is Lazy Betty.
Lazy Betty, the restaurant.
That's right. Yep.
Okay. And now featured on this Netflix show, The Final Table, brought together you and 24 chefs from all over the world to cook and compete in teams of two. First off, how did you even find out about this opportunity?
I was very lucky to befriend a very acclaimed Japanese chef, Shinichiro Takagi, who was my partner on the show. And I befriended him through my travels in Japan. I actually won a recipe contest while I was at Le Bernardin. And the people that were holding the contest, it was an organization that promoted Japanese food. It was called A6, based in New York. And first prize was to go to Japan and kind of learn about different styles of food and different cuisines within Japan. And I kind of parlayed that into a trip to visit each Shin at his restaurant Zenya in Kanazawa, and I actually made that connection through Sari Kawano, who owns Korin Knife Shop in New York. So before I went, I met up Sari, and she told me to go visit Shin, and she sent a couple emails and was like, "Can this young chef Ronald Tsu from Le Bernardin come work with you for a week?" And he was gracious enough to host me. He picked me up at the train station, and I got to spend a whole about almost 2 weeks at his restaurant, where he would pick me up at the hotel at 4 a.m. every day, take me to the market. We would go shopping for the ingredients for that day's menu. Then after that, we would go get coffee at the local coffee shop. And at this time, it was 6 a.m. Then he would give me the behind-the-scenes look at how he would conceptualize and construct the menu. And after that, I would end up at his restaurant at 7:30 a.m, where we'd work until 10 o'clock at night. And I did that for almost 2 weeks.
Wow.
And it was an amazing opportunity to, like, work with the chef one-on-one and, you know, have him spend so much time with me. It was really great.
And now you are again partnered with Shin Takagi.
That's right. That's right. So Shin got approached by Netflix. I'm not quite sure how Shin got approached to it, but he got approached by Netflix to be on the show. And he asked me just because we've befriended each other over the last 7-8 years. And, you know.
And he saw that you could get up at 4 a.m.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Well, each of the challenges on the show is based on around one country's cuisine. So how did you come up with the ideas of what to make under, it is a pressure cooker environment?
Yeah. So, you know, the first few episodes were kind of tough. We had to do Mexico, for example, and Shin has not had a taco in over 30 years. And I believe the place he had a taco was at Taco Bell, which is not really, you know, the taco that Enrique Oliveira is looking for. He's looking for something a little more craft. So he kind of had to lean on me a little bit. And plus, my family has been making burritos and tacos in their burrito shops for a while. So, you know, it was good. We had a good balance of knowing different kinds of cuisines. He's ultra focused in Japanese. I'm a little more trained in different kinds of cuisines. So, you know, we just kind of play to each other's strengths.
That's Ronald Tsu. He's a chef and Atlanta native, and he's on a new Netflix show called The Final Table. Well, I'm not going to tell people, I'm not going to give any spoilers about how you all fared, but being on that show gives you a platform to showcase the food of Atlanta. What makes it so different from the many places where you've been, Japan, working in New York, L.A.?
Well, you know, being on that show was really great. Being at the platform for The Final Table was a global culinary competition. I really feel like Atlanta, also an underrepresented part of Atlanta's culinary scene, is how global it is. I mean, you have Buford Highway, which has all sorts of cuisines, ethnicities out there. And then you also have Duluth, which is basically a little Korea. And I feel like, you know, when I got approached to do it, that I was like, you know, this is a way for me to really showcase a different side of Atlanta cuisine that's not really being featured much at all. And me being Chinese, I kind of felt like, you know what, this, I can be kind of like an ambassador for all these you know, ethnic cuisines and really try to show the world that Atlanta has a lot more to offer than just fried chickens and collard greens and biscuits.
What do you cook at Lazy Betty?
I cook, you know, so everyone asks me that. The only thing I can say is we're modern American. I use a lot of global flavor profiles. I try to find the best quality ingredients. I can't put a term on it. It's really just based off of what I've learned throughout my years traveling around the world and working in different high-end restaurants and in my parents' little mom-and-pop restaurant as well. And yeah, so I'll do everything from sea urchin to something a little more easy. Like I make a laminated biscuit. So
biscuit.
It ranges. There's a big range of foods that I like to do.
What do you laminate a biscuit with?
Well, it's butter and buttermilk still, but it's just the way you incorporate the butter is how you get the different layers and sheets of that flaky, rich biscuit.
Okay, your mom's name is Betty, isn't it?
That's right.
So you called the restaurant Lazy Betty. How does she feel about that?
My mom loves it. She loves being the center of attention. We took a personality test, and her personality is an entertainer. Mm-hmm. So she loves being the inspiration for the name of our restaurant. And she, ironically, she's not lazy at all. And the way we came up with that name was I took a red eye home from New York one day, and I went to my sister picked me up, so we went back to my sister's house. It was maybe 3 a.m, and my mom was babysitting my nephew and niece. And at that time, we walked in the door, and my mom was kind of sprawled out on the couch with like laundry all over her belly, and there was a little bit of drool coming out of her mouth, and we were like, "Yeah, there's our mother, Lazy Betty." And then we just sat there, we were like, "Oh, that's a catchy name," and you know, and we were like, "Why don't we name our restaurant that?" And we really liked it, and you know, the way my mom raised us was really indicative of what we want our restaurant to be. So we were like, "You know what? It sounds good. It's representative of the kind of restaurant we want to do." And so we ran with it.
And it's opening in 2019, right?
Yep, 2019. Depending on the construction schedule, we're looking at around mid to late January right now.
So with your MBA almost background, your chef school almost background behind you, what do you think opening this new restaurant? This is a big venture for you.
It is. It's going to be the first restaurant that I've opened from the very beginning. You know, I am the brainchild of it. I've developed most of the recipes along with my chef partner, Aaron Phillips. But still, a lot of the recipes have come from my childhood, my work experience. It's been very challenging. Even pulling 70 to 80 hour work weeks at La Bernardin fails in comparison to what I had to go through the past year to kind of find funding, to learn how to work with my family and not, you know, be at each other's throats.
I wouldn't know anything about that.
And
a new baby.
And a new baby. That's right. So just balancing everything has been super tough. And, you know, trying to find time to go do this TV show was really hard as well. You know, we weren't getting paid to do this TV show. So I was unpaid for a little while, too. So, you know, it was a lot to juggle at the time. But, you know, you just take it one day at a time and you get through it. And luckily enough, I have a very supportive wife who was holding down the house and giving me a lot of emotional support from back home.
All right. I can't let that go. You don't get paid for these things?
No, it was really just for bragging rights and just, you know, getting the experience of, you know, cooking for all these great chefs and showcasing your talent. So,
well, I guess that exposure is going to serve Lazy Betty very well.
Yes.
Thank you so much for speaking with us, Ronald. A real pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Atlanta native Ronald Sue. You can check him out on the Netflix show The Final Table or at his new restaurant, Lazy Betty, opening in 2019. It sounds like if it all goes on schedule.
That's right.
And that is our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and The Raven Taylor. Alec Caslow is our engineer, Don Smith helps out, and Amy Kiley is our senior producer. You can join the conversation. We're on Facebook and on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. This is On Second Thought.